Dosa Farmer acknowledges the traditional custodians of the various lands throughout Australia on which we connect today, and pays respect to elders past, present, and future.
Okay, so hello and welcome to another live episode of Dosa Farmer. And I'm Jess, and as part of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Week, I am joined by these three fantastic guests here who I'll have introduced themselves in a minute. And we'll be discussing the influence of their cultural and linguistic background on their research and careers. So to start off with, would you each be able to introduce your name and your pronouns, then go into a bit about your STEM career and your cultural background?
Hello, everyone. I'm Ruwangi Fernando. I am a data scientist, AI specialist. I did my PhD at Victoria University, which looked at how special events affects road congestion. So if you're heading for a footy game or, you know, Justin Bieber is here or any of that, the exceptional traffic conditions that as residents or, you know, visitors who is going along to the event, how we can better manage the situation, because these are exceptional situations, but these are planned events. You know, we know they are happening. They're not accidents. So how we can better manage the system using the past data and then learning from the current. And that was my PhD research area. But that was a particular project that I did. But my expertise goes along the way of machine learning and AI. Yes. And my pronouns are she and her. Yes.
That's awesome. Would you also be able to explain a bit about your cultural background?
So I'm from Sri Lanka. It's a lovely little paradise. Size of the Tasmania for y'all to be kind of relating it to. We do have, it's a very diverse country, having multiple religions and nationalities. Of course, we have gone through a civil war, but that's very political type. Like generally people who are living in Sri Lanka is very peaceful. Currently, we are going through another issue. But apart from that, we have like around 22 million people, but in that small country. And then if you go across any country, any significant organization, there is a Sri Lankan. So we are a history of 2000 years goes back. There is so much history. If you go there to have a look, there is the eighth wonder of the world is there, which is Sigiriya. So it's a lovely paradise, highly talented, highly potential people lives there, and it's been represented across the world. Yes, that's a snapshot of my country. Yes.
Okay, yeah, so hi everyone. My name is Bob Wong. I'm a professor and Australian Research Council Future Fellow based in the School of Biological Sciences at Monash Uni. I'm a behavioral ecologist, which means that I'm interested in studying animal behavior from an ecological and evolutionary perspective. And a lot of my research actually focuses on animal sex, how animals pursue reproductive opportunities, how they look after their offspring. But I guess over the years, being able to carry out field work in remarkable places around the world, I became increasingly interested in how human-induced environmental change can affect wildlife behavior and what consequences that might have. So a lot of my research nowadays actually focuses on pharmaceutical pollution and how that can disturb wildlife behavior, ecology, and evolution. I've served on various leadership roles, both within Monash and also in my discipline more broadly, including as deputy head of the School of Biological Sciences. In terms of my cultural background, I was born in Singapore. I'm of Chinese heritage, but I came to Australia when I was 6 years old and grew up in Canberra. I spent a couple of years after my PhD living and working overseas in the US and in Europe before coming back to Victoria to take up a position. And I've been a TNR academic since 2006, and my pronouns are he, him.
Good afternoon, everyone. Just thank you for the introduction, and it's great to be here. My name is Sid Verma. I am the, by way of my job, I'm the founder of a nonprofit called BrainSTEM, but really I help young people find their voice. The work that I do, that I've been doing for the last 20 plus years, is largely to do with mentoring young people, startup founders, entrepreneurs, women in STEM, high school students. And I increasingly am reminded of the fact that the legacy of what I'm doing at BrainSTEM is going to last well beyond my lifetime. So the work that I do is not for me, it's for the ones who will walk the paths, who go through the work that BrainSTEM is doing. I'm also an engineer. I've done my MBA in marketing. I've studied across the world in different sort of programs in leadership, in management. By way of history, I come from India, a land which is probably, I would say, significant diversity in terms of culture, in terms of language, in terms of race, in terms of religion, in terms of food, you name it. There's plenty of that to find. I was born in a family where my father was in the army, and we traveled all over India growing up. I've been to 12 schools by the time I finished high school, not because I was a bad student, but because I just would get transferred to a new city. So I became good at making friends quite easily in terms of understanding people, asking questions and observing. And that's what sort of helped me in settling in Australia, where I've been here for the last 23 years. This is home. Ish. I think home is always where you're born, but this is home. My pronouns are he and him, and I'm happy to share and answer my experiences and answer as many questions as you have got. So please keep them coming. Thank you.
Yeah, fascinating. So how has each of your cultural background and your experience with all these different cultures through traveling and meeting different people, how has that influenced where you've ended up today, particularly your work?
Yeah, so I think my particular culture, embraced in a diverse culture, of course, not significant close to India. I've traveled India quite a lot, and I know how it is lovely and how it's so diverse. The food is fantastic. You can be a vegan or vegetarian without no issues. I'm not a vegan or vegetarian in general life, but I love that country. So it's just a neighbor to us. But it's a very diverse country, Sri Lanka as well. So we have, I think, that influence over living close to different groups of people has been very instrumental in the journeys that I had. And also during my work life, I've been an academic all my life, I worked with the industries in that capacity, and also worked with university colleges or universities partnership within Sri Lanka, mostly from UK and also from Australia. So in that time, the cultures of experience that I was able to experience from those representatives and all of that, and then being an academic, you get to kind of work with people across the world. So those opportunities, I think it's always a new perspective, what a new culture brings. A lived experience from someone else brings you different perspective to what you do and how you should look at things. So culture has been always that sort of upbringing, but particularly from Sri Lanka, because of the heritage that we had and the things that we have done, you know, our natural sciences and many things, our ancient people has been so knowledgeable, and that really brings a lot of questions, and that has been, that curiosity, I think, would have come down to me in some sort of a way. My father was a very curious person. He's an engineer, and he was an engineer by real, like, you know, no books engineer. He's just like a hands-on guy who used to experiment with the very things. And, you know, having my sister, myself and mom, we didn't like that because the house is so messy, his stuff is everywhere. But that sort of curiosity, I think it was the one who would have maybe, you know, pushed me to that direction. But he was an electrical engineer, but no, my family didn't push me to take computer science. But at that time, it was kind of the coolest thing to do, computer science. So that's, I think, that I did. But if I ever had all of the options available, like, you know, Sri Lanka is a third world country, so it's not like Australia, so you don't have all options for you. But if I had those, I would have taken a choice of being a fashion designer. I don't know why, but I love that, you know, not for me personally, fashion, but that sort of a thing. But I think because of the colors and all of that, it's been very influential, you know, in Sri Lanka, what I experienced with the, you know, we have sometimes some festivals where you celebrate the same festival in a Tamil or a Hindu style, and also the Sri Lankan style. And also I'm a Roman Catholic, but you know, all the Buddhist festivals and everything, we used to kind of participate. The learnings and everything that you do with those, you know, making those lanterns, to so many things. There are learnings that you get from your culture. So I think culture has been influential. This can be relatable to each and every one of you, because, you know, culture has taken a significant role in our journeys. That's what I believe. Yes.
For me, I think appreciation of cultural background only really developed as I matured in my career. Sort of thinking back, I guess the one time where cultural background was an advantage when I was a student was when one of my tutors in first year biology pulled me aside. She just finished marking my report and she said, look, there were lots and lots of grammatical errors, but because you're an international student, I wasn't. She had made the assumption. She didn't mark me down for those grammatical errors. So that was the first time I sort of realized, oh, okay, maybe being of a non, you know, a Caucasian culture, the assumptions that came with that worked in my advantage on that occasion. But I think it's only really later on that I began to appreciate that that the cultural background is an asset. And I think growing up, I didn't quite appreciate that because, you know, coming to Australia at the age of six, I often found cultural clashes between my cultural heritage as someone of Asian heritage, and then also Western cultural values. Sometimes they did come into conflict. But I think as I matured in my career, I began to really appreciate that these things are assets, you know, being able to speak multiple languages, already being very comfortable in a very culturally diverse setting, traveling the world, you're interacting with colleagues and collaborators from right around the world, doing field work in remote areas where English is not the first language of the people that are living there. I think all of those experiences, including shared experiences growing up, being in a different cultural environment, can all come to play in a really positive way to advance and help your career.
I think cultural diversity equals resilience. I want all of you to understand that. I mean, we could talk all day about culture, right? But I think what's important to understand is that when a individual has diversity of culture, and by whether it's language or religion or nation or whatever it might be, you have gone through years in your life with multiple experiences, and having dealt with those and understood those conversations, that inherently builds and makes you a more resilient person. So that's an advantage. The other thing I think is also important to recognize is that when we start talking about culture in a different environment, you know, growing up in a different country, I'm assuming, to coming to a whole new place, there's a sense of absorbing someone else's culture and then hoping to be understood of your own culture by other people. And that's where the fight is. You know, how much of what I'm doing or behaving is understood by other people? We could also go into a whole new conversation about questioning our own culture as to why we do things we do, because our mom and dad said we should be doing it without asking why we should be doing it. Different conversation. But I think there's a range of values, and in many ways, cultural diversity is a superpower to have that a lot of people don't.
Yeah, you each touched upon it a bit. But how is diversity in general contributing to innovation in STEM as a whole and furthering research?
So diversity, just like before we start cultural, diversity is one of the biggest factors for innovation, because it's the lived experience of different ways of thinking. Because, you know, STEM has got it wrong in many circumstances. To go back a little further, you know, the seatbelts, you know, seatbelts are never made for women. And then because, you know, later when they thought about women, they left women in not the driving seat, in the other seat, because they thought, no, women won't be driving, you know. So these, you know, those kind of challenges have boiled down from the past. So that's particularly on gender, not looking at that. So like any sort of diversity comes from, gender, religion or race, sexual orientation, culture, and ability, right? So all of these forms of diversity is crucial, right? Of course, we are talking here about cultural diversity, which is one of the factors, but all of these lived experience, because if you are innovating things or even not just even making decisions, you need to be representative of a cross section of your society where you're serving, or these decisions will be affected. So that's very, very important. That's crucial to have. When you don't get it right, only all of these problems really would boil, because, you know, the technology that you have developed is not absorbed by the community, and all of that. But it's like, you know, and a lot of people think, oh, bringing diversity is like, oh, it's like the good thing to do. It's the right thing to do. No, not necessarily. Of course, yes, it is. It is the right thing to do. But it's also where the money is. And it's where the, where you can get things right, where you can be, competitive with your rest of your other competitors. Because when you are inclusive in all of the aspects, what you bring into the table is so solid, right? Because you have considered everyone across your society in your developments. So, the decisions that you make or the new technologies being developed. So this is very, very crucial to have. So particularly cultural diversity plays a huge role, like countries like Australia, because we are, 51% of Australians are either born overseas or at least one of the parents being born overseas. So this is a such cultural rich country, and the potential is huge there for that matter, right? So you have so much of variety of lived experience bring from people, and the uniqueness is that a lot of them are being grown up somewhere else. So it's not just that you boil down from your parents, intelligence about culture. This is real hands-on experience of you living in some other country and moving in here with all of those experiences, rich, learnings and everything. If you can be making them inclusive, like in Australia, you can really, really benefit in terms of innovation. So, this is basically where the money is for the STEM employers to look at, or like, if you wanted to get it, successful and get it really there. And also it's exactly the right thing to do. So I think that's where I would stop.
Yeah, I don't actually have much more to add to what Ruangi already said. I think it's very eloquently put, other than to perhaps share an anecdote of carrying on some of the themes that were brought up. So when I was asked to be the deputy head of school, Monash sends people off to this leadership induction program. And at the induction program, there was a facilitator who posed a question to everyone that was sitting there. And the question was, what is it that you bring to your role that no one else can bring? And it was a question that really had me stumped at the time, because I didn't see I never aspired to be, to a leadership role within my organization. And so I was feeling a huge imposter syndrome, lack of confidence being placed in that role. And then suddenly when someone poses that question, I felt like such a fraud in that room. I thought, well, there's so many other people in my department that would be really good in this role. And it was only 6 months later that I figured out the answer. I was a bit slow on the uptake. So what had happened was, 6 months later, I was sitting in my head of school's office, pitching to him the idea that we really needed to prepare promotional materials targeting international students in language. And I said that as first off the bat, I would really like to develop some promotional materials in Chinese, because at the time the China market was seen as a very important one for international students into the university, and there were opportunities that the Faculty of Science really wanted to explore. But I was really surprised during my investigations into all of this that we didn't actually have any materials in Chinese. And when I spoke to some people in my faculty and at the university more broadly, their response was, well, you know, these overseas students are coming to Australia. It's they're going to be learning English, you know, so they would understand the promotional materials. But that wasn't my lived experience. You know, as someone who was first in family, you know, my mum was born in Singapore also, and those who know Singapore would know that English is an official language there. So, so English was a language that I guess I spoke alongside Chinese, and my mum is also very comfortable in English. And in fact, we communicate mostly in English. But my dad was born in China, grew up in Hong Kong, and English, he wasn't as comfortable in English. And because my Chinese was, I developed my Chinese from just conversation with family, I actually didn't know how to say to my dad why I wanted to do science. I didn't know what the word for science was in Chinese. I didn't know what the word for biology was in Chinese. I couldn't articulate as well as I could in English to my mum why I wanted to do science or pursue science as a career to my dad. So my lived experience didn't sit very comfortably with what I was being told. And so I pitched this idea. I came through and I developed these videos, both in Chinese and in English. I helped with the script. I recruited a science student from China who was able to narrate both the English and the Chinese version, and to be able to understand that some statements in English wouldn't translate so well in Chinese, so we had to tweak some of those statements. And it was then that I realized, oh, that's what the facilitator was talking about. She was telling us to bring all of our lived experiences into that job. And we're talking about innovation. No one else in my school could have come up with that idea. So when that facilitator was asking about what is it that you bring to the role that no one else can bring, it finally dawned on me that she was talking about. And of course, one really important facet for that for me is my cultural background.
Yeah, I mean, look, diversity is an interesting topic, and you can't talk about diversity without inclusion, right? Diversity is a fact. Inclusion is a choice. Many organizations are now actively making that choice and making their teams, their workforce, their organizations more inclusive because they recognize the existence of diversity. And if you, when you go about your careers and your lived experience, your work life, if you find places where diversity is not being recognized and inclusive enough, walk away or say something. That's the first thing. Second thing is, have you ever taken part in a brainstorming session? Hands up, show of hands. Have you done brainstorming, ideation sessions? You have. Have you tried to come up with ideas by yourself? And how many ideas do you come up with? As compared to when you sit in a group and do brainstorming and you get 10x times those ideas. Why? Because when there's more contributions of ideas from different people and we are thinking, there's more wealth in the conversation and what comes out of it. That's what diversity is. So when you have people from different backgrounds coming together to solve problems, humans are consummate problem solvers, right? We are inherently in our DNA to solve problems. When you have a bunch of people from different backgrounds come together and solve problems, we will solve problems better. So I think from our point, from nothing, right? Absolutely.
So similar to the anecdote that Bob just gave, do any of you or Bob, do you have another story that you would like to tell in relation to your diversity that you just would like students to know and that they can be a bit more accepting of themselves and the impact they could make?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, I didn't realize that, you know, coming from culturally diverse backgrounds were an asset. And I sort of think about my own research career. I had amazing lecturers and mentors where I studied. I studied at ANU in Canberra. But it wasn't until 2002 when I attended my first international conference and I met a really highly regarded academic in my field of research. And I knew about his research, but for some reason I didn't associate his name as being of Chinese heritage. So meeting him for the first time, and I was just blown away by the fact, first of all, that he was Chinese, of Chinese background. And when we started chatting, I realized that his story was very similar to mine. You know, his family, in this case, was from China and migrated to the US. He spoke English with an American accent. After the end of that night, I remember walking home to my student accommodation and I was thinking, oh, wow, maybe I can potentially carve out a career as a behavioral ecologist as well. And it was such a powerful thing that I didn't even realize that I missed until I saw it. But oddly, I didn't make the connection of myself as an academic navigating my career path that my visibility is also important for others. And it's something that I've only realized in the last few years, which is why I'm sitting here in a forum like this today, because 5 or 10 years ago, I wouldn't have even thought to say yes or to think that something like this was important to share. Because at the end of the day, it's also deeply personal. We're sharing very personal things about ourselves. But during my career as an academic, there were times, you know, when you're standing in front of the lecture theatre giving your lecture, and of course the students can provide their student evaluations at the end. And two comments really stuck out in my mind. One was the very first time that someone commented about my race. Actually, it's happened twice, and both in a very positive way. One person just wrote Asian pride. And I thought, oh, wow, you know, like I never even thought about that mattered. I thought, you know, it's about how I teach and how I explain concepts. I didn't realize that just being an academic of Asian heritage, standing in front of that classroom made a difference to somebody. And then another student wrote something very similar, something along the lines, it was great to see someone of Asian background standing in the lecture, giving us a lecture. So, so another story there for you.
Yeah, just to add to that, and I think you touched on a few interesting points, confidence, carrying the burden of a community and such. And I remember, so I was doing a management program online on nonprofit leadership through Kellogg School of Management. And there's a subject on diversity and inclusivity in organizations and teams. And they gave an example, and I was sort of put on the spot intentionally. It said, Sid, we're designing this brand new program. This is sort of like a case study. And they said, we're designing this program, which is going to roll out across Southeast Asia. What do Indians think about this? And I'm like, obviously this is all role play, right? And I said, well, I don't know. I can tell you what I think. He said, good answer, because you might be from India, but you don't represent 1.3 billion people. So, but by default, if we are from a Czech background or a Chinese background or a Sri Lankan background, by default, if someone looks at you, you almost assume that I'm somehow answering for the entire country. I'm not. And so if you ever catch yourself thinking like that, don't. It's all right. You know, you can say, no, I can tell you what I think, not what somebody else thinks. The other example, and this keeps coming back to me, because we have a number of students from high school who go through our mentoring programs. And one of them, this boy, he was in year 9, he came up to me and said, Sid, I've taken part in your program, and it's a 12-week STEM mentoring program, and we'll talk about that later. But he said, after coming to your program, I've realized that I want to go into clinical research. But my mom and dad are dentists. He's an Asian kid. And he said, and they want me to become a dentist. So I'm going to talk to my dad this weekend and explain to him why I don't want to become one. And I'm like, good, mate. If you need help, let me know. And I'm happy to sort of get on a Zoom call with your mom and dad. But he's in a, he'll be fine anyway. But anyway, he comes back to me the next week, and you couldn't see, you know, he couldn't wipe the smile off his face. And he's like, I spoke to my dad and my mom, and they understood why I'm doing something. And they were apologetic because they thought that I wanted to become one because they were one, and all of those sort of things. And so we shouldn't forget the fact that there's a lot of inherent bias and assumptions that come with culture and diversity that people find it hard to let go of. And a lot of that comes from lack of confidence and self-belief. And the other thing I want to finish off with very quickly is that you spoke about vulnerability. And I think there's so much strength in being vulnerable. You might not get the answers and the responses you want when you're vulnerable for the very first time or the first few times, but it gets better. So, you know, over time, build your vulnerability quotient and become a stronger person, and you will discover a whole new of yourself, which you never knew existed before.
Right. I would like to add to that a bit more, and especially also make a turnaround in my introduction, just to introduce that I'm also the founder for STEM Sister and also the co-founder of iSTEMCo. So these two organizations, like STEM Sister, has been founded since 2017, where I was started my PhD journey, and iSTEM is much more recent in 2022. So through both these organizations, what we do is we empower STEM women of color. The reason is when I talked about the diversity categories and all of that. So when these diversity categories get into combination, we call it intersectionality. And that can be really challenging, right? Because you not just identify being a woman, but you identify with maybe with a disability, or, you know, you identify with a sexual orientation, or with a different culture or a race, or all of that. So you have more than two, it's even challenging. So this particular aspect is something that not considered in most of the circumstances. Not all women, of course, you know, we think about getting the gender right. I do understand that, because it's like the majority men and female, like, you know, men and women, and that's like, you know, 50-50. But what intersectionality plays within a woman is, and especially like countries like Australia, with so much of culturally diverse population, is tremendous. So actually, we haven't had much attention on this regard. So that's what STEM Sisters started, because there was a significant problem in terms of within the community of STEM, particularly, because I'm just narrowing down to the area of STEM, not looking at this from a women's perspective. So because the challenges, like I always say this, you know, all women go through a glass ceiling, no question about it. But what we face, anyone with an intersectionality, what we face is a concrete ceiling or a bamboo ceiling. You talk about providing tools, the government, other, you know, responsible organization, providing tools to break a glass. Can you use the same tool to break a concrete or a bamboo ceiling? You can't. The tool has to be different, right? So if you haven't thought about that, the support by, you know, spending millions or billions of dollars is simply not applicable for that portion of the community. Now, looking back, what's that portion of the community? So until 2020, there were no statistics to look around how much this diversity exists. Like, you know, what these women really represent. I know, like, you know, STEM women is a problem across the world. Not just in Australia, but Australia are also suffering, which around 29% is represented by women, and like certain areas like construction, engineering, the numbers are really, really poor. So we talked about why we need to get those numbers up because of the innovation and all of that profit coming across. But when you look at to that women section who is already there, 56% of Australian STEM university qualified females are born overseas. So you can see the majority of university qualified women are there from culturally diverse backgrounds, right? So that's very large portion, like basically the majority over here, right? And then we face 4 times higher unemployment compared to women born in Australia. We were in 2006, we were in much better place. We were like having 5% unemployment. By 2016, which is the latest statistics that we have, is 14.1. So you can see that because there have been no that unique support to break that concrete or the bamboo, that's why this has come through in that fashion. So this, even just to begin to have a look, is just we are starting. So STEM Sisters is an organization, we support this particular problem. Like I started it without even not knowing, you know, what's the problem or the real gravity of the problem. But now we know, and we support it with a range of opportunities. Like you can find this information online, so I will not go deep over there what we do. But the support that we were able to provide for our community, we can really see a positive change. And also the discussion, like a lot of people, like I always say, like if you are facing a difficulty, it's important that you voice it. At the same time, like, you know, I like other individuals also need to kind of listen, but it's in your responsibility to raise it as well. If you're facing a disability, someone with not that exact disability wouldn't understand unless that you kind of find a way to communicate that as well. So it's a responsibility from both the side. So that's what SEMSIS is doing. We are trying to create awareness on the matter. So people, because I've come across people, they're wonderful people, but they've never understood there is a different layer of challenges because they don't have that lived experience. So when we voice it and say, no, you know, it's not all women cut from the same cloth, right? They're all so different. So, and the challenges are so different. So you need to pay the significant, you know, measures in terms of supporting these women. So I do, like, you know, my talk can be biased for women of color, but as I said earlier, you know, I'm a human who supports all diversity. We need to bring, like, we shouldn't be waiting to think about, sexual orientation or disability or any other form of diversity, like, after we figure out one thing. No, we need to do everything at the same time. Really, if you can represent or support the cross-section of the community, that means that's what you should do. So, yeah.
So the issue of intersectionality is something that I feel very strongly about as well. And in fact, we were talking about this very issue just before we started. So I'm also someone who's part of the LGBTQI community. And I was actually here last at Monash Parkville campus at an event for queer scientists. And of course, those issues were compartmentalized, but I did make the point then as well that these aspects of intersectionality are really, really important. And we were discussing before the start of this panel discussion that I once spoke to a very senior member of my faculty about the issue of how can we get better gender equity in our academic staff. And I did raise the issue of culture as well and issues of intersectionality, because there has been research carried out published by the Asia Institute, not far from here at Melbourne University, on the experiences of Asian academics in Australian tertiary institutions. And it revealed, perhaps unsurprisingly, that although people of Asian heritage have perceived barriers, women of Asian heritage have higher levels of perceived barriers than men of Asian heritage. And so I was recounting this bit of, you know, data that I just learned about to this individual. And they said, well, you know, women do make up 50% of humanity and we have to start from somewhere. And I just thought that was a really inadequate response, because people of color make up the majority of humanity. And you know, we're smart people, we can multitask, we can deal with multiple issues at the same time. So I think compartmentalizing things or not being able to deal with issues of intersectionality is a real shame, because it really misses a huge part of the story.
Yeah, oh wow, that brings a lot to think about. So to wrap it up today, so looking into the future, what are your hopes for cultural diversity in STEM?
I'm a very positive person, and I see the positive in things. Like, you know, I address the challenges because we need to move forward. That's simply always what we look at for. So even STEM sisters, we talked about the difficult conversations, because we need to get the attention of the, you know, the right people who makes those policies or who allocate the funding to all of that. So we really need to make those difficult conversations. But for Australia, what I can see, as I said, we are really, really potentially having a great set of talent over here. Right. You know, having this much of diversity is one of the key things for success. So we basically have this with us. So what I can see is huge potential for Australia. And we just have to kind of, you know, figure out things, maybe learn that we have kind of not got it right still. But as you know, we said, you know, we just can move forward from here, you know, and it's not that difficult to move forward. There are organizations, there are people who are representing that are queer in science that I know of, you know, look, all of these things are being established, and they're coming from their lived experience, bringing the, you know, information in. So if these can all come together, we can really enable of inclusive of everyone. But he said, inclusion is a choice. So we have to make that choice happen. With that choice, the potential is huge. So even for cultural diversity, it goes in the same hand. Yeah.
I guess when I was at uni, we didn't have forums like this. You know, we didn't have these kind of organizations like Brains and STEM or STEM Sisters. And so I think we've come a long way. So from something that wasn't even spoken about, at least we're having conversations about these things. So what I hope for the future is actually for us to no longer needing to have these kinds of conversations because it's so ingrained. The other thing that I want to point out is that at the moment with a lot of these sorts of things, the burden is still on those that are underrepresented to be sitting in these kinds of panel discussions or to set up these organizations, you know, and it does come with huge responsibility. It can come with career implications as well. And I think, I don't know how we get there, but it needs to be a much broader involvement of the community. It shouldn't just come down to those who are underrepresented to be the advocates. Everyone has a really important role to play. We need allies right across the board.
Your question was about the future of diversity in STEM, right? And I shouldn't say that I take objection to that, but I think it's an incomplete question because the fact that there is diversity in STEM is already there, right? So the future of is already here. It's already an existing, it's an existing diverse community. Like there are many other communities. We just want to define it as a STEM community. So what I know is going to happen is that the more these sort of conversations happen, where more people from diverse backgrounds come and talk about, and I also, I'm not sure if it's a bugbear, but I don't know, pick a word. People who do come from different backgrounds often make the assumptions, and I'm a victim, I'm guilty of that as well, that there's something that I need to scream louder to be heard. That there's something already not right about me. And if I don't scream loud enough, people will not hear me. So I should just, you know, overcompensate for it. The more normal conversations we have in existing conversations, the more normal it will continue to become. When I say we, I talk about BrainSTEM, the nonprofit that I run. We have a whole range of people who volunteer and you're all invited to be volunteers in BrainSTEM. Because it is a very diverse audience. Through participating in organizations like BrainSTEM, like STEM Sisters, like other such organizations, you lend your voice to those conversations. You learn from being present in other conversations, which then makes you a richer person. And I think that the more these sort of avenues happen, does make for a much richer, normal, equitable, balanced community within Australia and globally. So let's keep doing more of what we're doing. It'll be fine.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing your personal experiences and allowing us to have this conversation today.
Then I think that brings us to an end. And just once again, thank you all for coming and sharing your stories and having this conversation.